Charles Simeon, who was a pastor in Great Britain, the late 1700s, early 1800s, an evangelical Anglican, said, "The whole of man's pilgrimage on earth is but a succession of trials and deliverances." Simeon continued that thought by pointing out that God ordains it to be this way. God ordains this series of trials and deliverances because it is for our greatest good. Experientially, many of us would agree with this statement. And not just experientially, but scripturally. When the Apostle Paul is writing to the church at Rome concerning tribulation, he says that it brings about perseverance, and perseverance proven character, and proven character hope, and hope does not disappoint because the love of God has been poured out within our hearts. Now, if we take out the center portion of that structure, tribulation brings about the love of God being poured out in our hearts. We can see exactly what Simeon is talking about when he says the whole of our pilgrimage on earth is a succession of trials and deliverances. And we see that displayed for us among the Israelites of old as well. The frequent occurrences of difficulties that the Hebrews face in the wilderness journeys serve for us as a lens for us to see ourselves as the church in the world today. If you haven't seen yourself in the lives and the journeys of the Hebrews or the Israelites up until this point, then you aren't looking, and you will see, continue to see, as we make this journey through Exodus, our lives and our experiences mirrored very well. We come to Exodus 17 today, and we're not going to look at the entire chapter, but just the first seven verses that we read as the last section of our reading this morning. God has led his people away from the place of peace and plentiful provision where he had turned the bitter water sweet, and they had all the water they needed to drink and all the food they needed to eat, bread in the morning, quail in the evening, rest on the seventh day. Now they've gathered up all of their belongings, and in stages or in large groups, they're making their progress, making their way through, progressing through the wilderness. Now, previously, a couple of weeks ago, we saw that it was indeed a very bitter trial when the waters at Meribah proved so disappointing to the Israelites. They were thirsty, 3 days' journey. They see on the horizon what might be an oasis. As they approach, it's true, water's there. Their hopes are gaining, but the water's bitter, and it was a terrible disappointment. But God made the bitter water sweet, and he quenched their thirst, every single one of them. And now here, before too long at all, that dark trial of thirsting resurfaces. And this time it's darker still. I mean, there was some hope before, right? It's non-potable water, but it's water. Now they're in deeper into the desert. The masses have trekked deeper into the wilderness. And there's no water at all, no bitter water, none to speak of. And they thirst and they search, but all of their efforts appear to be in vain. The trouble of thirsting had died when the bitter water was made sweet. And now this trouble, this trial lives yet again. This is a common circumstance in the life of faith. Like Simeon said, all of our pilgrimage on earth is this succession of trial and deliverance, trial and deliverance. We can look throughout the scriptures and see the life of Joseph. His brothers throw him in the pit. He's rescued from the pit. And where does he find himself? Imprisoned in Egypt not long after that. Or what about David? 1 Samuel 22. He's safe there from his enemies in Adullam's cave. You flip over one chapter. He's running for his life out in the wilderness of Engedi. All of our pilgrimage on earth is a succession of trial and deliverance. We can think of it like a wheel, the spoke falling one moment only to rise in the next. A cycle. Or the tide. It may be ebbing now, but it's going to roll in again soon enough. The Israelites, the entire congregation, all of them, a huge number of people, have come to the wilderness of Sin, or what is probably Sinai, to a place called Rephidim, which translated literally means resting place. You have to believe they know where they're going, and the anticipation is great. They're ready to get there. They're thirsty. Unlike before, when they started with full skins or canteens, we might say, of water, and it lasted a couple of days, and then they went a long day looking for more water. More than likely, they did that again when the bitter waters were made sweet at Marah. Surely they filled up their skins again and set out on the journey, but now it's gone. They've run out. They need water. Their kids need water. Their livestock needs water. And they're wandering deep into the wilderness, into the desert, and there's no water anywhere in sight. But they know that they're headed to a place called the resting place. And you can't really rest if you're thirsty without having something to drink. But again, just like before, the incredible anticipation that must have been building up within them brings about huge disappointment. But no worries, though, right? I mean, think about the previous history of these folks. Surely they're not going to be frantic and frustrated and grumbling and complaining and quarreling. I mean, they've just seen God work in these exact circumstances. Surely they're going to just turn their hearts toward Him in faith, in prayer, trusting in His faithfulness to provide what they need for sustenance. Surely they don't believe that He's accomplished all that He has done through the plagues, through the wonders and signs toward Egypt and Pharaoh, and parting the Red Sea, and allowing them to worship Him in song, and providing sweet water that was once bitter, and manna by day and quail by night, and rest on the seventh day of each week. Surely they aren't willing to argue that He's done all of that just to now let them die deeper in the wilderness and in the desert. One would think that would be the case. But as we saw in our reading, it's simply not true. They camped at Rephidim, the end of verse 1. There was no water for the people to drink. Therefore, because there's no water for the people to drink, and they've never seen a miracle of anything like providing water or making water stand still, like walls on each side of them while they pass through on dry land, they quarreled with Moses, demanding that he give them water. Moses asked, "Why do you quarrel with me? You realize, right, that you're just testing the Lord?" They continue grumbling with Moses. "Why have you brought us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" And Moses cries out to the Lord, "What shall I do with this people a little more, and they will stone me?" They're grumbling again, complaining, rebelling again against God, just like they have previously. "Is it because there were no graves in Egypt?" they ask before, "that you've taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us in this way? Why in the world did you bring us out of Egypt in the first place? Don't you remember, Moses, we said to you in Egypt how much we loved working for Pharaoh? How we had all the food we wanted to eat. We sat by these full pots of meat. It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians all the days of our life than to come here and die in the wilderness." And then when they come to the bitter waters, they grumbled at Moses. "What shall we drink, Moses? This water is no good." In Exodus 16, they grumbled against Moses. "What are we going to eat?" And then here in 17, it's the same story. The people of God quarreling with Moses, saying, "Give us water. Why in the world did you bring us up? Was it to kill us and our entire families and everything that we own, all of our livestock as well? Now, the people here, no doubt, are assuming that they're aiming their disgust at Moses. Okay? I don't think if we could sit and talk with any of those Israelites, they would actually point the finger at God. Moses is their great problem. He has been from the beginning. But Moses makes it clear to them that their real argument is not with him. He's only God's representative. Their argument was with God. That's where their real problem lies. Though they were striving against Moses by revolting against his authority, it was ultimately God who was in their sights. Not only that, but the accusations that are made here from the Israelites against Moses, they've reached new heights. The complaining and grumbling, we've said before, was tantamount to rebellion. But here, the word quarreling that's used is even a stronger concept. The argument, the complaining, the grumbling, the rebellion has reached new heights. Not only are they arguing and complaining and quarreling and grumbling and rebelling against Moses and against God, they've charged him with attempted homicide. Even genocide, we might say. You've brought us here to kill every single one of us. So the accusations continue to rise. Now, it's important to notice that it was Moses who led all of these masses of people to Rephidim. But there's no reason for us to think that Moses led them there to get anything to drink. I don't know that Moses, when he set out to Rephidim and everyone following him, had any inclination of whether or not there would be anything to drink. I'm not sure he cared at that point whether or not there was anything to drink. He set out to Rephidim not to give them what they thought they wanted in water. He set out because that's where God told him to go. He was simply obeying. Not because there was water there or because it was some sort of place of rest and he could see the fatigue and the thirst in the eyes or in the faces of the people. Moses led the Israelites to Rephidim because God told him to go there. And God told him to take the Israelites there in order to expose the Israelites that they were not satisfied in God. That they didn't trust him. And that is exposed. It's revealed very soon after they arrive when they begin complaining and grumbling and quarreling and accusing. Complaining reveals this in us as well. When we are complaining, even if we're pointing the finger at someone else, ultimately, we are not trusting in God. We are proving that we are discontent and unsatisfied with who He is and the circumstances that He has created as a sovereign God for us to live in. All of our dissatisfaction reveals that we're disappointed in God and or what He's given us. Now, I'm not suggesting that it's wrong for us to take our troubles to God in prayer. We see Moses being the example that we should follow here. You have to think Moses was thirsty too. But he's not accusing God. He's not looking for someone to blame it on. He goes to God in believing prayer. What shall I do? He remembers the signs that have happened. He too walked across on dry land. He held his staff out and watched the water split. He held his staff out again and watched all of the enemies destroyed. He picked up the tree and threw it in the water and watched the non-potable water become sweet to the taste. It's not wrong for us to take our troubles to God in prayer, but it is wrong for us to revolt against His authority and His will. It's wrong for us to refuse to trust Him in complaining and grumbling and arguing and accusing are all forms of rebellious revolt against God. Now, I know it's easy for us to think that complaining is not that big of a deal or grumbling is not that big of a deal or accusing can't be that huge of an issue. But when Paul's writing to the Apostle Paul's writing to the church at Corinth concerning this specific passage, he's just stated that this rock that's following around the Israelites is Christ, which we're going to get to in a moment. He goes on to say, these things have been recorded for your instruction, for your help. Don't be idolaters, like some of them were. Don't act immorally, like some of them did. Don't try or test the Lord, like some of them were so prone to do. And then he says, don't grumble, as some of them did. I wonder if complaining and grumbling in our minds is comparable to idolatry, immorality, and testing God. The Apostle Paul lists all four of them together. They were idolaters, immoral, trying the Lord, and grumbling. And Paul says, don't be like them. They are examples for you not to follow. Now, if we're going to heed the apostles' advice here and not grumble as some of them did, then we probably should look a little bit closer at exactly how they grumbled. Because it's fairly unlikely that many of us have ever been really thirsty and couldn't find a drink and blamed God for it. But there's more going on here. They complained in three ways specifically here that I want to look at this morning. First, they were demanding God's provision. Second, they were denying his protection. And third, they were doubting his presence. First, demanding God's provision. Give us water that we may drink. Not asking, not praying, demanding. They didn't go to Moses and ask. They didn't even go to God and ask. They weren't content to wait on God and to watch him provide. They had no confidence, no trust that he really cared anything for them, even though they had just experienced remarkable deliverance at his own hand on their behalf. They insisted on him providing without even going to him. They told God that he must give them what they wanted or else. Give us water or else. I wonder how many of us are guilty of this. I mean, I mentioned already, not saying give us water, but are you guilty of insisting that you have things your way? I mean, when God doesn't do what you think he ought to do, do you complain? Do you grumble? That's insisting that God has somehow sold you a bill of goods, that he's given you the short straw intentionally. At home, at work, at church, when things don't go the way you think they should, what is your response? Demanding that God change your lot? Demanding that he provide something different? Not only were they demanding God's provision, but denying his protection. Look at verse 3. Why now have you brought us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? And they're assuming the worst about God. They haven't even gone to him and asked him, God, what are you going to do this time? I mean, the anticipation that they had in thirst, you would think with the recent days and history that they have and seeing the remarkable hand of God displayed on their behalf, that they would be anxious to see, I wonder what he's going to do this time. I wonder how he's going to bring water from the sand or from the rocks or from the sky. He's made bitter water sweet. He's made the dew basically turn into bread in the mornings. He's made the quail come in and do everything but cook and clean themselves for us. I wonder how he's going to do it this time. But instead of that, they run quickly to assuming the worst about him. Going so far as to even conclude that he's already abandoned them. That he set them out to this area called a resting place merely just to trick them so that they would die there without anything, just leaving them there for dead. And as I mentioned before, their words are directed at Moses, but their hearts were aligned in opposition against God. They were accusing God of trying to harm them, which is almost impossible for us to fathom, considering how God has gone out of his way to rescue them, to destroy their enemies to the degree that every one of them was destroyed, and they're laying there face down, lifeless on the beach after they've crossed over on dry land. And now they're accusing God of trying to harm them. But I wonder if it feels the same for us when we complain and when we grumble about what God is doing in our lives, when we're faced with hardships and trials and difficulties and sufferings. I wonder if it crosses our mind that our complaints and our grumblings are denying God's protection, not believing that he is who he says he is, not trusting that he will indeed care for his own. In a very real sense, for us to complain is to accuse God of lying. For us to grumble and accuse is to call him a liar. It's accusing him of breaking his covenant with us. He's promised not to leave us or forsake us, to do us good all the days of our lives, us and our children. That's the promise in the new covenant. So for us to accuse him, to complain, is to accuse him of breaking his covenant with us and to call him a liar. They were demanding that God provide for them. They were denying that his provision that he was providing for them. And then the last verse that we read together, verse 7 of chapter 17, they ask the question, is the Lord among us or not? Doubting his presence. I don't know how much doubting it was as exclaiming. They were convinced that God was not with them from their perspective. If things didn't happen in the manner that they desired, they assumed that God wasn't among them. As if he existed just for their happiness, to meet every felt need that they had. The lack of water makes them wonder whether or not God is with them. Now, that's one thing if they've been provided for on a silver platter every day for their entire life, and this is the first day they've ever awakened to be thirsty. Then they think, oh no, what did we do? Something's different today. But it's simply not true. Their recent history is enough for them to not even think twice about what they're going to drink, but merely look up and trust and beg God to show himself strong and mighty on their behalf yet again. When things became difficult for them, or less than ideal, we might say, the immediate response is, where is God? And oftentimes that's true for us. The day is going difficult, or the week is going difficult, or life in general is just incredibly tough. Where is God in all of this? Why is this happening? I mean, do you find yourself questioning him or questioning his presence in the midst of trials? Does not having everything you think you need result in grumbling and complaining, doubting God's presence? It almost seems impossible to us that the Israelites could respond in this way. But when we pull back a little bit, and we don't just look from a distance at the Israelites, but we put ourselves in their positions, or we look at our own experience in recent days, do we not see evidence of the same types of responses in our lives? Demanding his provision, denying his protection, doubting his presence. I mean, think about what they've experienced. God heard them and answered their groans and their cries. God sent them a deliverer in Moses. The plagues that were mounted against their enemies, the remarkable rescue across the Red Sea. Has God not heard and answered a number of your prayers? He's heard and answered a number of prayers, even in the midst of our Wednesday evening prayer meetings recently, or the ladies' prayer meetings. The men, when we've gotten together to pray, we've seen clear answers. 2.5 weeks ago, we asked for favor for the Greens visa. It was a preliminary visit. No expectation that they would give the visa, only that they would be able to go and apply for the visa. The next morning, we get a phone call, an email. They've received the visa, not just able to go and apply for it. This past week, we prayed for the work in Dunbar, for the pastor and his wife there needing a place to stay. I get an email mid-morning Friday. God's provided a place for them to stay. We've seen time and again God hear and answer prayers. God no doubt has sent a deliverer, not in Moses or any human person, but in Christ. All of our enemies have been conquered. The victory has been won. There's been a remarkable rescue. We have walked across on dry land, suffering none of the wrath of God. It all has been poured out on Him. The destruction of Pharaoh and his army, the bitter water made sweet, the manna given 6 days a week, the quail provided as meat for them, rest granted on the seventh day. Do we not have provision, all of this provision and more in God? And yet they wondered, is God with us? Is He really protecting us? Is He really concerned about us? Is He really going to provide for us? Is He going to continue? Is all of our Christian life based in the past? When we sing the song, O God, our help in ages past, which is true and it's wonderful, but we can't live on yesterday's graces. He is as well our hope for years to come. We have to continue hoping in Him. Their unbelief, the Israelites' unbelief, is almost unbelievable when we read it. I mean, I don't know about you. I think I've mentioned this before, but you can just about get frustrated with them. Until you remember that spiritual forgetfulness is astounding in the Israelites. It's even more astounding when we see it in our own lives as we look into the mirror of the Scriptures. The psalmist must have had the same kind of astounding response. In 106, he records, God rebuked the Red Sea and it dried up. He led them through the deeps as through the wilderness. He saved them from the hand of the one who hated them. He redeemed them from the hand of the enemy. The waters covered their adversaries. Not one of them was left. Then they believed His words. Then they sang His praise. Then they quickly forgot His works. Just like that, turning on a dime. The psalmist is astounded by it, and he records exactly what happened. Their forgetfulness. When they forgot to remember the kindness that God had shown them, it resulted in grumbling complaints. And if that's the case, then the remedy, without question, for discontentment and dissatisfaction must be remembering what God has done. And that's not just by process of elimination, but God has actually commanded that it be that way. If we look back to chapter 12, He instituted the Passover, the memorial, the feast, the consecration of the firstborn once they arrived in Canaan. He set up all of these things so that we might be serious about remembering all that God has done for us and all that He continues to promise to do. When we're in need, when we're in need of provision, rather than doubting whether or not He's going to provide, why not recall the numerous ways that God has met our needs for food and housing and employment and friendship over and over again, and then remember that He's a God who never changes. How will He not again provide all that we need? When we're in need of protection, when we deny and doubt whether or not God is protecting us, why not revisit the places in our lives where God has protected us, where He's kept us from physical danger, where He's preserved us from the consequences of our own poor choices time and again? Why not revisit there and remember that He's a God who never changes, that He's promised to protect us and to keep us all the way to the end? Or when we're in need of His presence, when we feel like He's far off and we're suffering and things are hard, why not recount in our hearts and minds those times and those places that God has drawn near to us and relive them again, as it were? Not so that we're caught up living in the past, but so that we're hoping continually in Him, realizing that He hasn't changed, that the promise stands firm, draw near to me and I will draw near to you. He has been our provider, our protector, and He is our ever-present help. Now, it's obvious to us on this side of history, especially with it clearly stated in the story here that we're reading in the scriptures, that God is testing the Israelites. He said that at the waters of Meribah. Moses cried out to the Lord. The Lord showed him a tree. He threw the tree into the waters. The waters became sweet. God made for them a statute and a regulation. And there He tested them. God is testing His people regarding the manna, the same thing. The Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I'll rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them whether or not they will walk in my instruction." But at this point, when the people of God come to Rephidim, they're tired of being the ones tested. So they return the favor. They put God on trial, charging Him with neglecting to provide for them, charging Him with failure to protect them, and charging Him with refusing to be present with Him. And as I mentioned previously, they even go a step further and accuse Him of attempted murder of every single one of them and their children and their livestock. Not only had they rushed to a verdict, they were quite anxious, it appears, to carry out the sentence. Remember what Moses said? "They're just about ready to kill me." They had obviously made it clear, "He's our problem. We'll kill the Lord's representative." The picture here that's detailed for us is one of legal proceedings. Look at verse 5. "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Pass before the people, take with you some of the elders of Israel, take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go.'" Now, granted, this kind of court, it's more like the people's court than the Supreme Court, but it was court nevertheless, and I'm not sure in our day and time that there's a lot of difference between those two anyway. But the Israelites were attempting to hold God responsible with the way things were going. They were failing to trust His plan, that His plan was good and gracious, and they wanted to bring Him to justice over not keeping His end of the bargain or the covenant. And we're often so guilty of this same fault without realizing it. Instead of beginning with God and evaluating our situation from His point of view, we're so prone to begin with our circumstances, and then we quickly proceed to judging Him from our circumstances rather than from His vantage point. We should be really careful to remember that it doesn't matter what kind of verdict we may reach about God and what He's doing. What matters is the verdict that He declares over us. Or we could say it this way, the way the writer of Hebrews said it: "Take care that there not be in any one of you an unbelieving heart that falls away from the living God." So the people are putting God to the test. And what I find worth note here is that though the people are putting God to the test, which is a ridiculous notion to say the least, God goes along with their despicable plan. And He gives them the hearing, we might say, that they're longing for. And in doing this, He teaches them about His salvation by submitting Himself to judgment. But what He didn't do was submit Himself to the judgment of the people. He submitted Himself to His own judgment. "I will stand before you on the rock." Strike the rock. And when Moses did, Psalm 105:41, God opened the rock and water flowed out. It ran in the dry places like a river. God opened up the flesh of His Son and life flowed out and it ran in the dry crevices of our hearts and gave us life. When the water flowed freely, so freely that day, the provision that they had demanded was granted. The protection that had been that they were denying that God was offering was provided. The presence that had been doubted on their part was evidenced. Again, the psalmist, Psalm 78, God split the rocks in the wilderness and they gave them abundant drink like the ocean depths. This is not Moses taking his staff and striking a large stone and it puts out a little bit of water like a water fountain. It was like the ocean depths. He brought forth streams from the rock and caused waters to run down like rivers. It's no small supply. I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, we're not talking about a half a dozen of folks here who are thirsty. Not only did it provide for them, but all of their livestock as well. They were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them, Paul writes to the church at Corinth. And the rock was Christ. It was mighty in strength, steadfast in surety, eternal in loving kindness. It doesn't take much for us to listen close and hear that it's not just God saying to Moses, strike the rock. But we hear the whispers, maybe even louder than a whisper, of God himself saying, strike the sun. And by that strike, his people are satisfied. Or the way the prophet Isaiah says it, by his stripes, we are healed. The water from the rock that day, in Exodus 17, alleviated their thirst. Then, but the spiritual supplies of grace that flow from the true rock that is Christ, satisfies thirst, spiritual thirst, to such a degree that even Jesus himself said, those who drink of this water will never thirst again. And it's not because they take a sip and are satisfied forever. It's because they take a sip and it creates an appetite that's so insatiable, they never stop drinking all the days of their lives. And as a result, they're satisfied in him. Again, Psalm 114, tremble before the God of Jacob. Why, David? Because he turned the rock into a pool of water, the flint into a fountain of water. It's a remarkable picture here. God striking his son on behalf of his people and turning him into a free flowing river of life so that whoever comes and drinks will be satisfied. This day in the wilderness and that day on Calvary, Christ was struck. And this day in the wilderness, everyone who drank was satisfied. And they were all thirsty and they all drank. And this day, today, everyone who comes to Christ and drinks will be satisfied. The question we have to ask is, are we thirsty? Or have we suppressed the thirst that every single one of us were born with other things? Again, concerning this exact story the psalmist records today, many years later, today, if you would hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as at Meribah, as in the day of Massa in the wilderness when your fathers tested me, they tried me, though they had seen my work. For 40 years I loathed that generation and said, they are a people who err in their heart and do not know my ways. Therefore I swore in my anger, they shall not enter my rest. Today, if you hear his voice, today, if you hear him, Christ, standing at the end of the Feast of Booths in John chapter 7, saying, if anyone is thirsty, come to me and drink, and I'll cause rivers of living water to flow from his innermost being. Today, why stand idly by demanding God's provision when he's provided it so freely? Why deny his protection when he's promised so wonderfully to protect his own? Why doubt his presence, his manifest, cultivated, kindred presence that we can know intimately and personally. There's no reason to demand his provision. He himself tells us that he's given us everything pertaining to life and godliness. He didn't spare his own son, but he gave him up for us all, and now freely gives us all things in him. It makes no sense at all for us to deny that God is protecting us. He says, John 16:33, in the world you will have tribulations, but take courage, because I've overcome the world and all of the tribulations. I lay down my life for the sheep, he says. How can you accuse him of not protecting you? He laid down his life for the sheep, and he goes on to say, no one can snatch them out of my Father's hand. That's in John chapter 10. And then at the end of his life, I will never leave you nor forsake you. I'm with you always, even to the end of the world. It makes no sense for us to be caught up in the same kind of miserable situation, accusing, complaining, grumbling that the Israelites of old found themselves in. The rock which was Christ, which is Christ, has been struck, and life has come out of him. And it's a free-flowing fountain for all of us to continue to go to and find all of our satisfaction, our provision, our protection, and his presence among us. May God help us to live on these truths. Let's pray together.